So I haven't given the talk yet, but I've already come up with the title, which is, I'm going to call it The Story of Ur, which is short for Uruk. So I'm sure that helps quite a bit. Actually, what I've been contemplating a lot the last couple of months is stories. And so just thinking about stories and why we tell them, what they say about us or our society or community. Why do we tell them? Is it helpful? Is it hurtful? Profitable? Unprofitable? How does it come about? How do the stories, get told? These are just questions that in my head and others kind of around stories. I don't know if I have any answers, but they're kind of there, kind of contemplating. I have just returned from a 7-week trip to England and Italy, visiting various of our monasteries. So you might think that coming back I'd be telling a lot of stories about being over there. I know probably people would like to hear some things that happened over there, but I don't intend to do that tonight. The main intention of going over to Amaravati was to spend some time with Ajahn Amaro, and also I knew I'd get a chance to visit various monasteries while I was there, and really just wanted to get to meet the community members. We see the list of who's participating and the rains retreated, all of the monasteries, and you can get familiar with the names over the years, but you don't have a personality to put to the names. And so it was really quite special to go over and to meet the people, and I just feel that closer connection. It's like I can almost kind of relate to them as sort of being, if not siblings, of cousins or nephews. So it's there's a sort of a family sense of connection with the people that have done training like we have. When I first arrived, I'll also tell one story. When I first arrived, everybody was, I'd say everybody, it was like the person who picked me up in the car, so the first person I met, and then over the next couple of days, probably 3 or 4 people wanted to tell me this story. And the World Cup rugby tournament had just happened, and I think it was played in England. And everybody wanted to tell me the story about this one player from New Zealand who played for the All Blacks. His name was Sonny Bill Williams. So I'm not seeing anybody nodding their head and sort of knowing who he is. So this is great. This is a brand new story for everybody here. But Sonny Bill Williams is kind of what's known as the enforcer, I guess, on the team. He's like also a professional boxer, heavyweight boxer, and kind of had a really rough, I guess he has a kind of a rough personality, kind of maybe he wasn't always the ideal teammate to have. That's kind of what some people have told me. I tried to look up online today to see if this was actually true or not, but I couldn't actually find any information on that. So anyway, he's just a professional athlete, been spending his entire, pretty much probably his entire life, sort of training as an athlete and training to be on the big stage to compete for a world championship. And the All Blacks did win, and they won the tournament. I guess they're the first team ever to win it consecutive tournaments in a row, so it was like a really big deal. And of course, New Zealand's such a tiny island, and to have their rugby team, a lot of pride in that. And so everybody on that team will probably have some sort of hero status when they get home. And at the award ceremony, they had all just received their medals, and the team was kind of walking around the stadium, just around probably about 50 feet away from the seats, and we're just kind of walking around waving to the crowd. And And there's a news camera was there, and this like 12-year-old little boy, you know, saw his hero, his star player, and sort of jumped over the fence and ran up and wanted to just, you know, give this player a hug. And Sonny William, and wanted to give him a hug, but a security guard, you know, saw this, you know, flash of this little boy running, and the security guard was at a full run, sort of just, you know, pancaked this kid right in the middle of the field, and he was like right in front of Sonny. And as he was going down, he's sort of reaching, you know, for the rugby player, and the rugby player sees all this, and he just, you know, immediately sort of reaches down and sort of pulls the boy up, and then of course the boy's just, you know, hugging him, and just you know, this kind of joyful sort of moment, and it's kind of funny. You watch the security guard, and he doesn't know what to do. He's kind of like, "Hey, I was just doing my job," and people are kind of giving him a hard time, but the rugby player just sort of just puts his arm around this little boy, and sort of, you can see, kind of asks him, like, you know, "Where are your parents?" And so he kind of walks him over into the crowd, and of course, and then all the cameras are on them, and this little boy is just like, just ecstatic, just really, you know, blissed out that this, you know, player is actually taking the time to you know, just spending some time with him, and that in and of itself would be a great story. But then when he gets to the, you know, to the edge of the, where the seats are, and he's just, you know, saying goodbye to the kid. He actually said a few words to him, and then just as before he turned around, he reaches up and he takes his medal that he spent his entire life working for, and takes his medal off and he gives it to the little boy. Yeah, and but the expression on the little boy's face, I mean, he literally goes into ecstasy. He just goes into bliss. And, you know, it's like when you think about that, it's like, you know, that if the Sonny had just, you know, kept the medal, yeah, it would have had a lot of joy for him, you know, to see that over the years. It would have, you know, it did bring a lot of joy to the people of New Zealand. You know, it had a lot of effect there. But just that selfless act of, you know, just taking 2 minutes out of his life to, you know, just give his attention to this boy who idolized him, and then, you know, to give away this, you know, really valuable possession, you know, just gave it to him. And because of that, like, millions of people have seen this image. You know, it's just like, you know, like the first time I heard it, I started crying just, you know, thinking of just the goodness that action is going to have in the world. So that's, you know, that's the power of a story too. You know, this, the stories we tell can be uplifting. They can inspire us to do selfless acts, to help people, to be more conscious of our intentions. So stories aren't necessarily, you know, bad. When I was with Ajahn Ahimsako, when somebody else had told us the story, the same story, and Ajahn Ahimsako had a story of, we tried to verify this one, but we couldn't either. But it wasn't the current queen, but there's sort of a urban story that one time the Queen of England was at a state dinner, and she, you know, it's very, very formal, and I think you're even like given sort of etiquette lessons before the meal when you have with the queen, and of course there's always, you know, lots of dignitaries and diplomats, and it's a, you know, very formal situation. And so everybody's there at the table, and, you know, everybody's probably very nervous about, you know, doing everything right, and one of the guests you know, didn't know the etiquette, didn't know it very well, like probably from a, you know, country that you know, quite far away, and had very, very different customs. And the on the table was a bowl of water with some lemon in it, like a slice of lemon, and it was for washing your hands, maybe for, like, you know, dipping your fingers into it to you know, kind of get maybe the smell of some food off of your hand, and then you dry it. And this dignitary, you know, reached over and thought it was for drinking, so he reaches over and takes the cup with both hands, and you know, drinks his bowl and sets it down. Of course, everybody else at the table is panicking, like, oh no, you know, what are we going to do? So the queen reaches over and grabs the bowl, her bowl in front of her with the lemon in it, and drinks her hand washing water. And so it's just this, you know, really beautiful story of just, you know, really being, you know, attentive to the situation and, you know, just how to be, you know, just, it was a really kind thing that the queen did, just to, you know, relax that tension, or, you know, just show the other, just give an example to the other guests of, you know, we don't necessarily have to follow all the rules in that particular situation, or, you know, just, you know, make this person feel welcome, feel comfortable. Now the story of at the very beginning of this year, several of us were living at the Pacific Hermitage, and it was the very end of the winter retreat, and we arranged to go up to Birken Monastery the last 2 weeks of our winter retreat. And our joke was at the time as we were going up there to make sure Ajahn Siddhanta came back. He had just spent a year on retreat there. So we went up to bring him you know, back down to the hermitage. And while we were there, we did it was very informal, but it was still a retreat time. But I forget what Ajahn Sona calls it, but I won't tell you where it is, because it's either called the Secret Library or the Forbidden Library. But he has a library that's has books that wouldn't just normally be on a monastic. A lot of it was like you know, psychology books or history books, things like this. And so I was up in this little library, and I noticed a book called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And so he was a king in the city of Uruk. And as soon as I saw the book, I remembered I'd read that in college about 30 years ago. And just even seeing the title, though, I remembered something. I felt really uncomfortable just seeing the book. And so I remember, and I just, you know, started thinking about it. I picked it up. I was like, okay, what's this about? Just read the back cover. And then I remember when I was a student, you know, reading this book and just not feeling like the conclusion was that there was something wrong, you know, with it. Unsatisfactory dukkha. You know, when we studied this and you know, at the time I didn't know why, couldn't maybe put my finger on it. So I asked Ajahn Sona if I could, you know, read it, and he actually gave me the book, and so, you know, I read it. And just in brief, the story of it is it's a really fascinating story, is that they think that he was probably Gilgamesh was a real person. The myths and the stories that came up probably weren't true, but in the epic poem that was written, well, to start off with, it's probably the oldest piece of literature that they found, and it's 3rd millennium BC, so it's like 4,000-year-old poem, and it's like, you know, 2,000 years before Christ. And in this story, Gilgamesh is probably a young king, and he's full of conquest and war and building projects and unfilled desires, and so he's just has, you know, all this energy. And so the people of Uruk pray to the gods that they'll create an equal, somebody that can challenge him, and sort of maybe their energies will be, you know, against each other, or, you know, some sort of way to tame his passions. And so they make this, the gods sort of grant this, and they make his equal. He's more of a wild man, but Enkidu is his name. Love these names, Enkidu. And but they end up doing all these sort of, the gods sort of throw out some challenges to them of trying to conquer some of the protective deities in the forest that are around them, and some sort of magical beings and things. And so that kind of sounds like the gods are maybe even trying to get them killed by having him do these things. But Gilgamesh and his twin, they succeed in all of these battles and trials, and so the gods get really upset, and so they end up killing Enkidu as kind of punishment for their having done the things that the gods asked them to do. So it's like, you know, life is unfair. It's like, you know, one of the first things that Gilgamesh kind of learns. And then he goes into deep despair because he really loved his brother, and so he sets out on a journey to try to find eternal life. And so it's a really perilous journey, and he's traveling, and he finally gets to like this huge ocean, and he meets this goddess named Siduri, I think was her name, and she's kind of a goddess of wine, and she's kind of challenged him, like, you know, like she hasn't seen humans because it's such a long journey to get there, and she's like, you know, what are you doing here, and, you know, why do you look so haggard and drawn and you know, starving and you're wearing tatters and stuff. And he's like, well, why shouldn't I look this way? You know, it's like my brother's died, and, you know, I'm grieving, and I'm, you know, trying to find, you know, some way to eternal life. And she just looks at him and says, you know, that's not the lot of humans. You know, it's like human beings are mortals, and you do die. And, you know, why don't you just, you know, go back to your city and eat as much as you want, drink as much as you want, you know, wear fine clothes, you know, take showers all the time, feel the touch of your child's hand in your hand, and, you know, just enjoy life. You know, that's part of being human as well. And that's like, you know, her advice. And then he rejects this. He says, no, that's, you know, I'm not settling for that. And so she tells him about this ferryman who will take them to this man named Oop Napishtin. I love a man whose name has Nap in the middle of it. That's great. Oop Napishtin. And so he does this perilous journey across the ocean, and he gets there, and he meets him, and Oop Napishtin is a human being, but he is immortal. And Gilgamesh knew of him, knew who he was, and everybody kind of knew about him. And he's like kind of shocked. He's like, you know, I expected, you know, to find some immortal man that would be like really kind of like a warrior and, you know, some sort of great looking being. He says, but you look a lot like me, kind of haggard and worn out. And then he says, you know, so what's your story? You know, how did this happen to you? How did you become immortal? And it turns out he's Noah. The equivalent of Noah in the Bible. And so, yeah, the gods came and told him that they were going to flood the earth, and that he was supposed to build an ark and to get two baby animals. So it's a slightly different story, but two baby animals of every animal that's on the planet. And then, yeah, sure enough, the flood happens, and they set out the different birds. It's actually the raven that doesn't come back in the story. And so this is the first recorded story of the flood in the Epic of Gilgamesh. And then, but the gods, sort of as a quote-unquote reward for his having done this, they grant him immortality. And so that's how he became immortal. So Gilgamesh is like, well, could you... give me an introduction to the gods, you know, maybe, you know, like, you know, maybe they'll grant this to me as well, even though I didn't, you know, do anything like that. And Oop Napishtin says, well, if you can stay awake for 7 days, I'll at least, you know, give you an introduction And as soon as he says this, Gilgamesh falls asleep. And he falls asleep for 7 days. And to kind of prove that this has happened, Upnapishtim has his wife bake 7 loaves of bread, one for each day that he's there. And so when he wakes up, he's got these loaves of bread in all various stages of decomposition. And so he kind of realizes that it's true. And then, interesting, it's like kind of side story, this is that kind of as a consolation, because he realizes he's not going to get to see the gods, he's not going to get his chance to be immortal. Upnapishtim gives him kind of tells him that there's this particular flower that grows on the bottom of the ocean, that if he can find it, that will give him rejuvenation powers, not immortality, but it will give him the ability to rejuvenate, and kind of not for himself, but for all of humanity. And so he does find this on his way back, and then he stops at a well for some water, and a snake steals the flower. So that's why the snake kind of sheds its skin, because of this. And so, but anyway, so he does all this traveling, and he gets back, and when he does talk to, actually before he leaves, and he tells Upnapishtim that, you know, that because he also challenges him, says, you know, well, you're a human being, what are you doing here? And, you know, look how wretched you look. And he tells him this, and Gilgamesh tells him the story, and Upnapishtim looks at him and he says, nothing's permanent. That's his one comment to him, because he's grieving the death of his brother. And that's his one line of wisdom. It's like, yeah, nothing is permanent. And then, you know, then he sends him back as well. So like the two sort of beings that he does meet that are, you know, kind of gods or immortals, you know, are basically just telling him that, yeah, there is impermanence, and, you know, just basically go and just, you know, just try to be as happy as you can. That's what humans do. And that's pretty much how the story ends. And I remember at the time in college, you know, when I read that, thinking that's unsatisfactory. that they have, you know, and then reading it this time, it was really clear to me that, you know, it's obvious that Gilgamesh is very much in touch with dukkha, you know, just the unfilled desire and the grief and sorrow of the loss of his twin, and the hardship of the travel, you know, seeking this something you could think of as quite noble, you know, that journey to, you know, kind of reconcile that grief about his brother. And so he definitely knows dukkha, and he definitely sees impermanence, and, you know, he's been giving that advice. But it's, you know, in terms of the Buddhist teachings, you know, the anatta, that sense of not self, you know, is not touched upon in that story. And then at the same time that I say I read this, I was right after I left the Birken Monastery, and they went to go spend some time with my parents, and my parents' minister wanted me to see this movie called Boyhood, and which came out this year, and very quickly, it's a very interesting concept movie where the director filmed it over a 12-year period, and they used the exact same actors throughout the entire movie, and so it kind of just shows the aging process of this family. And at the kind of the way the movie ends is the youngest boy in the movie, and he's just graduated from high school, and I think like second to last scene of the movie, he's with his father at some sort of nightclub, and the boy asks his dad, you know, like, what's it all about? You know, what's this, you know, what's getting ready to go out into the world, you know, what's it all about? And, you know, through the scenes that have already happened in the movie, the little boy is very aware of dukkha. You know, there's a lot of abuse that happened in his life as he was growing up, and he's very aware of change and impermanence. So again, he sees the dukkha, and he sees anicca. And, you know, the boy's father's, you know, sitting there, and he's like, his response was, I have no idea, you know, what's it all about. And so, you know, having read the Gilgamesh, and then having, you know, watched this movie, it was like a lot of gratitude, you know, came up for, you know, us having the story of the Buddha, and, you know, having that, you know, sense of that there is, you know, we do have that missing piece that most people don't, of the not self. That's why, you know, had us chant that this evening, just to kind of have that into our consciousness. And it was interesting that I've been, you know, holding on to this story of Gilgamesh, you know, the entire year, at least since March. And I was talking to Ajahn Son about it when I was there, and he was like, you know, that'd be a great essay. You know, you should, you know, develop that, or, you know, kind of, you know, work that into some sort of, you know, some sort of teaching. And I was always thinking of it in that terms of, you know, that's that missing piece of anatta. But then, you know, just sort of this last couple of weeks or months, just thinking about stories, and you know, I could see, you could really clearly see, you know, this connection as well. It's like, you know, one thing that stories do is it tries to answer questions. And sometimes we think of stories as telling, you know, telling of a history or a narrative. But I think at one level, what we're trying to do with stories is we're trying to figure out, you know, where we fit in the world, you know, where we do see that impermanence, and we do see the suffering. And so stories can hopefully, you know, try to give us a sense of permanence, a sense of safety. And so, you know, we see situations and try to, you know, figure out, yeah, where do we actually stand in this situation? At least I can see that for myself. And when I was thinking about this talk a couple of years ago, I read the Jill Bolte Taylor's book on her called My Stroke of Insight, where she had a stroke, and it was completely, you know, basically had to start from scratch to sort of, you know, bring herself back into, say, normal sort of consciousness, or, you know, being able to be functional in the world. And the first part of when she's in her recovery, she's what she calls in the right kind of hemisphere of her brain, and she calls it like sort of, you know, like being in nirvana, in nibbana, or she kind of uses this really, you know, kind of overly exaggerated, I think, but sort of, you know, being in kind of the blissful states of mind, and, you know, kind of more like kind of a spiritual realm where it's you know, very free and in the present moment kind of parts. This was a long time ago since I read the book, so I'm probably way oversimplifying the way she talked about it. But then she does talk about it very clearly, like when the left hemisphere starts to heal, and she starts able to access that part of the mind, that she said at first she was actually her profession before she had the stroke was she was a neurologist studying the brain. And she does give a TED talk where she said when actually the event happened, when she had the stroke, she was like, oh, this is amazing, this is great. You know, like how many, you know, neuroscientists have actually ever, you know, actually able to study the brain, you know, from the inside. This is going to be great. And she kind of had it in the back of her mind, but I'm too busy for this, so I'll give it 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it ended up being like 12 years, the recovery process. But when the left hemisphere started kicking in, she was, you know, kind of trained in studying the brain and how it worked, and so she was fascinated by it. But she said when that part of the brain kicked in, it's kind of the more analytical. It sees patterns, and she said one of the major processes of what that part of the brain does is it tells stories, and you know, kind of makes sense of the world for us. But she said as she was watching watching it happen, you know, so I can see from her perspective, it would be like really clearly, she said like what would happen is in her mind is she would get like, you know, just two pieces of information that might be completely unrelated, and the mind would then just fabricate the story. And it's like, you know, like there might be 100 points in between the original two, and the mind made up 98 of those points, you know, to make this story. And she said at first she thought it was kind of humorous. You know, it was like, isn't that amazing how the mind is doing that or creating that? You know, just getting these, you know, just two points and then making this story in reality. But then she said she got scared because she realized the mind, the left hemisphere, actually expected the rest of her mind to believe the story. You know, really, she was like, you know, oh, this is truth, this is factual, this is as it really is. So she said, you know, she's always tried to cultivate that sort of a real sense of detachment and just a clarity around, you know, when she does need, well, when she's in the storytelling mind, you know, it's like, you know, just storytelling about herself, you know, like, you know, judging mind or praising mind or just you know, any kind of stories that we normally do. She said, you know, she could look at it from a this position of, yeah, don't trust that. Ajahn Amaro used to always, you know, this is probably a good reminder since we're heading into the winter retreat, but he used to always, especially during the winter retreat, he'd always use the phrase, it's like, you know, stop creating each other. And for the longest time, I had no idea what he meant by that, but it's just it's exactly what Jill Bolte Taylor was saying. It's like, we just can get, you know, two pieces of information about each other, about what's happening in the community. You know, from say you could be one point of perspective, and then just, you know, seeing a facial expression from somebody, and then we read, you know, enormous amounts into it. And I always think like during the winter retreat, it's because, you know, there's a much more restraint and lack of speech and lack of communications with each other. That, you know, if we are always looking for that sort of sense of security and sort of like knowing who we are, how we fit into the community, you know, having that story, you know, it's like, you know, when we're in the normal working sort of part of the year, you know, we have so many more points of reference, and, you know, maybe the story would tell us a little more accurate. Probably not, but we do usually have the, I always think speech, you know, you can tell just by the quality of speech, there's so much you can read into it besides what's said, just the how loud it was said, how soft it was said, you know, how much time they gave to you to tell some information. You can read a lot into it, so there's more sense of, you know, just being able to feel safe or comfortable in a particular situation just because of speech. And so when you don't do that, then it's like, yeah, if the mind is wanting to tell these stories, then you're looking at facial expressions or body movements, and then I think there's a lot more chance for error in our correctly perceiving what's happening. So I think that's, you know, what a lot of what Ajahn Amaro was pointing out. You know, don't create each other. So don't, yeah, we see each other. We're kind. We're, you can give each other space and things like that. But, you know, to try to just be aware of the storytelling mind. When we do start to create the narrative, yeah, just be cautious of that. Well, like I said, I had the title figured out, and I haven't figured out the ending, so I think that's probably a good place to end there. So I'll leave this for our contemplation.
Sadhu, sadhu.